wrapped a paper collar around my neck. "Quite a lot," I said truthfully.
"Well, you're in God's country now. How short do you want it?"
"Short enough so I don't look like a hippie," I almost finished, but Balmer wouldn't know what that was. "Like a beatnik."
"Let it get a little out of control, I guess," he began to clip. "Leave it much longer and you'd look like that faggot who runs the Jolly White Elephant."
"I wouldn't want that," I said.
"No, sir. He's a sight, that'un."
When Balmer finished, he powdered the back of my neck, asked me if I wanted Vitalis, Brill Cream, or Wild Root Cream Oil, and charged me 40 cents. I call that a deal. My $1,000 deposit at the hometown trust raised no eyebrows. The freshly barbered look probably helped, but I think it was mostly being in a cash-and-carry society, where credit cards were still in their infancy and probably regarded with some suspicion by thrifty Yankees. A severely pretty teller, with her hair done up in tight rolls and a cameo at her throat, counted my money, entered the amount in a ledger, then called over the assistant manager, who counted it again, checked the ledger, and then wrote out a receipt that showed both the deposit and the total in my new checking account.
"If you don't mind me saying so, that's a mighty big amount to be carrying in checking, Mr. Amberson. Would you like to open a savings account? We are currently offering 3% interest, compounded quarterly."
He widened his eyes to show me what a wonderful deal this was. He looked like that old-time Cuban bandleader, Xavier Cugat. "Thanks, but I've got a fair amount of business to transact." I lowered my voice.
"Real estate closing, or so I hope. Good luck," he said, lowering his own to the same confidential pitch. "Lorraine will fix you up with checks. 50 enough to go on with?"
50 would be fine. "Later on, we can have some printed with your name. And your address?" He raised his eyebrows, turning it into a question. "I expect to be in Derry. I'll be in touch."
"Fine. I'm at Drexel 84777.
I had no idea what he was talking about until he slid a business card through the window. Gregory Dewson, assistant manager, was engraved on it, and Drexel 84777. Lorraine got my checks and a faux alligator checkbook to put them in. I thanked her and dropped them into my briefcase. At the door, I paused for a look back. A couple of the tellers were working adding machines, but otherwise, the transactions were all of the pen and elbow grease variety. It occurred to me that with a few exceptions, Charles Dickens would have felt at home here. It also occurred to me that living in the past was a little like living under water and breathing through a tube. I got the clothes Al had recommended at Mason's Menswear, and the clerk told me yes, they would be more than happy to take a check, providing it was drawn on a local bank. Thanks to Lorraine, I could oblige in that regard. Back at the Jolly White Elephant, the beatnik watched silently as I transferred the contents of 3 shopping bags to my new valise. When I snapped it shut, he finally offered an opinion.
"Funny way to shop, man."
"I guess so," I said. "But it's a funny old world, isn't it?" He cracked a smile at that.
"In my opinion, that's a big you bet. Slip me some skin, Jackson."
He extended his hand, palm up. For a moment, it was like trying to figure out what the word Drexel attached to some numbers was all about. Then I remembered Drag Strip Girl and understood the beatnik was offering the 50s version of a fist pump. I dragged my palm across his, feeling the warmth and the sweat, thinking again, "This is real. This is happening."
"Skin, man," I said.
I crossed back to Titus Chevron, swinging the newly loaded valise from one hand and the briefcase from the other. It was only mid-morning in the 2011 world I'd come from, but I felt tired out. There was a telephone booth between the service station and the adjacent car lot. I went in, shut the door, and read the hand-printed sign over the old-fashioned payphone.
Remember, phone calls now a dime, courtesy of Ma Bell. I thumbed through the yellow pages in the local phone book and found Lisbon Taxi. Their ad featured a cartoon cab with eyes for headlights and a big smile on its grill. It promised fast, courteous service. That sounded good to me. I grubbed for my change, but the first thing I came up with was something I should have left behind. My Nokia cell phone. It was antique by the standards of the year I'd come from. I'd been meaning to trade up to an iPhone, but it had no business here. If someone saw it, I'd be asked 100 questions I couldn't answer. I stowed it in the briefcase. It would be okay there for the time being, I guessed, but I'd have to get rid of it eventually. Keeping it would be like walking around with an unexploded bomb. I found a dime, dropped it in the slot, and it went right through, to the coin return. I fished it out, and one look was enough to pinpoint the problem. Like my Nokia, the dime had come from the future. It was a copper sandwich, really no more than a penny with pretensions. I pulled out all my coins, poked through them, and found a 1953 dime I'd probably got in change from the root beer I'd bought at the Kennebec Fruit. I started to put it in, then had a thought that made me feel cold. What if my 2002 dime had gotten stuck in the phone's throat instead of falling through to the coin return? And what if the AT&T man who serviced the payphones in Lisbon Falls had found it? He would have thought it was a joke, that's all, just some elaborate prank. I somehow doubted this. The dime was too perfect. He would have shown it around. There might even eventually have been an item about it in the newspaper. I had gotten lucky this time, but next time I might not. I needed to be careful. I thought of my cell phone again with deepening unease. Then I put the 1953 dime in the coin slot and was rewarded with a dial tone. I placed the call slowly and carefully, trying to remember if I'd ever used a phone with a rotary dial before. I thought not. Each time I released it, the phone made a weird clucking sound as the dial spun back. "Lisbon Taxi," a woman said. "Where the mileage is always smileage. How may we help you today?" While I waited for my ride, I window-shopped my way through Titus's car lot. I was particularly taken by a red 54 Ford convertible, a sunliner, according to the script below the chrome headlight on the driver's side. It had white wall tires and a genuine canvas roof that the cool cats and drag strip girl would have called a ragtop. "That ain't a bad one, mister," Bill Titus said from behind me. "Goes like a house afire. That I can testify to personally." I turned. He was wiping his hand on a red rag that looked almost as greasy as his hands. "Some rust on the rocker panels," I said. "Yeah, well, this climate." He gave a what-are-you-going-to-do shrug. "Main thing is the mud is in nifty shape, and those tires are almost new." "V8? Y-block," he said, and I nodded as if I understood this perfectly. "Bought it from Arlene Hadley over Durham after her husband died. If there was one thing Bill Hadley knew, it was how to take care of a car. But you won't know them, because you're not from around here, are you?" "No. Wisconsin. George Amberson." I held out my hand. He shook his head, smiling a little. "Good to meet you, Mr. Amberson, but I don't want to get you all over grease. Consider it shook. You a buyer or a looker?" "I don't know yet," I said, but this was disingenuous. I thought the Sunliner was the coolest car I'd ever seen in my life. I opened my mouth to ask what kind of mileage it got, then realized it was a question almost without meaning in a world where you could fill your tank for $2. Instead, I asked him if it was a standard. "Oh, yeah. And when you catch second, you want to watch out for the cops. She goes like a bastard in second. Want to take her for a spin?" "I can't," I said. "I just called a cab." "That's no way to travel," Titus said. "If you bought this, you could go back to Wisconsin in style and never mind the train." "How much are you asking? This one doesn't have a price on the windshield." "Nope. Just took it in trade day before yesterday. Haven't got round to it." He took out his cigarettes. I'm carrying it at 350, but tell you what, I dicka. I clamped my teeth together to keep my jaw from dropping and told him I'd think it over. If my thinking went the right way, I said, I'd come back tomorrow.
Better come early, Mr. Amberson. This one ain't going to be on the lot for long.
I was again comforted. I had coins that wouldn't work in payphones. Banking was still done mostly by hand, and the phones made an odd chuckling sound in your ear when you dialed. But some things didn't change. The taxi driver was a fat man who wore a battered hat with a badge on it reading Licensed Livery. He smoked Luckies one after the other and played WJAB on the radio. We listened to Sugar Time by the McGuire sisters, Bird Dog by the Everly Brothers, and Purple People Eater by some creature called a Sheb Wooly. That one I could have done without. After every other song, a trio of out-of-tune young women sang 1440 WJAB, the Big Jab. I learned that Romanow's was having their annual end-of-summer blowout sale, and F.W. Woolworth's had just gotten a fresh order of hula hoops, a steal at $1.39.
Goddamn things don't do nothing but teach kids how to bump the hips, the cabbie said, and let the wing window suck ash from the end of his cigarette.
It was his only stab at conversation between Titus Chevron and the Tamarack Motor Court. I unrolled my window to get away from the cigarette smog a little and watched a different world roll by. The urban sprawl between Lisbon Falls and the Lewiston City line didn't exist. Other than a few gas stations, the High Hat Drive-In, and the outdoor movie theater, the marquee advertised a double feature consisting of Vertigo and The Long Hot Summer, both in CinemaScope and Technicolor, we were in pure Maine countryside. I saw more cows than people. The motor court was set back from the highway and shaded not by tamaracks, but by huge and stately elms. It wasn't like seeing a herd of dinosaurs, but almost. I gawked at them while Mr. Licensed Livery lit up another smoke.
Need a hand with your bag, sir?
No, I'm fine. The fare on his meter wasn't as stately as the elms, but still rated a double take. I gave the guy $2 and asked 50 cents back. He seemed satisfied with that. The tip was enough to buy a pack of Luckies. I checked in, no problem there. Cash on the counter and no ID required, and took a long nap in a room where the air conditioning was a fan on the windowsill. I awoke refreshed. Good. And then found it impossible to get to sleep that night. Not good. There was next to no traffic on the highway after sundown, and the quiet was so deep it was disquieting. The television was a Zenith table model that must have weighed 100 pounds. Sitting on top was a pair of rabbit ears. Propped against them was a sign reading, Adjust antenna by hand. Do not use tinfoil. Thanks from management. There were 3 stations. The NBC affiliate was too snowy to watch, no matter how much I fiddled with the rabbit ears. And on CBS, the picture rolled. Adjusting the vertical hold had no effect. ABC, which came in clear as a bell, was showing the life and legend of Wyatt Earp, starring Hugh O'Brien. He shot a few outlaws, and then an ad for Viceroy cigarettes came on. Steve McQueen explained that Viceroy's had a thinking man's filter and a smoking man's taste. While he was lighting up, I got off the bed and turned the TV off. Then there was just the sound of the crickets. I stripped to my shorts, lay down, and tried to sleep. My mind turned to my mother and father. Dad was currently 6 years old and living in Eau Claire. My mom, only 5, was living in an Iowa farmhouse that would burn to the ground 3 or 4 years from now. Her family would then move to Wisconsin and closer to the intersection of lives that would eventually produce me. I'm
crazy, I thought. Crazy, and having a terribly involved hallucination in a mental hospital somewhere. Perhaps some doctor will write me up for a psychiatric journal. Instead of the man who mistook his wife for a hat, I'll be the man who thought he was in 1958. But I ran my hand over the nubby fabric of the bedspread, which I had yet to turn back, and knew that it was all true. I thought of Lee Harvey Oswald, but Oswald still belonged to the future, and he wasn't what was troubling me in this museum piece of a motel room. I sat on the edge of the bed, opened the briefcase, and took out my cell phone, a time-traveling gadget that was absolutely worthless here. Nevertheless, I could not resist flipping it open and pushing the power button. No service popped up in the window, of course. What had I expected? 5 bars? A plaintive voice saying, "Come home, Jake, before you cause damage you can't undo." Stupid, superstitious idea. If I did damage, I could undo it because every trip was a reset. You could say that time travel came with a built-in safety switch. That was comforting. But having a phone like this in a world where color TV was the biggest technological breakthrough in consumer electronics wasn't comforting at all. I wouldn't be hung as a witch if I was found with it, but I might be arrested by the local cops and held in a jail cell until some of J. Edgar Hoover's boys could arrive from Washington to question me. I put it on the bed, then pulled all of my change out of my right front pocket. I separated the coins into 2 piles. Those from 1958 and earlier went back into my pocket. Those from the future went into one of the envelopes I found in the desk drawer, along with a Gideon Bible and a hi-hat takeout menu. I got dressed, took my key, and left the room. The crickets were much louder outside. A broken piece of moon hung in the sky. Away from its glow, the stars had never seemed so bright or close. A truck droned past on 196, and then the road was still. This was the countryside, and the countryside was sleeping. In the distance, a freight train whistled a hole in the night. There were only 2 cars in the courtyard, and the units they belonged to were dark. So was the office. Feeling like a criminal, I walked into the field behind the motor court. High grass wickered against the legs of my jeans, which I would swap tomorrow for my new Banlon slacks. There was a smooth wire fence marking the edge of the Tamarack's property. Beyond it was a small pond, what rural people call a tank. Nearby, 6 cows were sleeping in the warm night. One of them looked up at me as I worked my way under the fence and walked to the tank. After that, it lost interest and lowered its head again. It didn't raise it when my Nokia cell phone splashed into the pond. I sealed the envelope with my coins inside it and sent it after the phone. Then I went back the way I came, pausing at the rear of the motel to make sure the courtyard was still empty. It was. I let myself into my room, undressed, and was asleep almost instantly. Chapter 6. The same chain-smoking cabbie picked me up the next morning, and when he dropped me off at Titus Chevron, the convertible was there. I had expected this, but it was still a relief. I was wearing a nondescript gray sport coat I'd bought off the rack at Mason's Menswear. My new ostrich wallet was safe in its inner pocket and lined with $500 of Al's cash. Titus came over to me while I was admiring the Ford, wiping his hands on what looked like the same rag he'd been using on them yesterday. "I slept on it, and I want it," I said. "Oh, that's good," he said, then assumed an air of regret. "But I slept on it, too, Mr. Amberson. And I guess I told you a lie when I said there might be some room for dickering. Do you know what my wife said this morning while we were eating our pancakes and bacon? She said, 'Bill, you'd be a damn fool to let that Sunliner go for less than $350. In fact, she said I was a damn fool for pricing it that low to start with.
I nodded as if I'd expected nothing else. "Okay," I said. He looked surprised. "Here's what I can do, Mr. Titus. I can write you a check for $350, good check, Hometown Trust, you can call them and see, or I can give you $300 in cash, right out of my wallet. Less paperwork if we do it like that, what do you say?" He grinned, revealing teeth of startling whiteness. "I say they know how to drive a bargain out there in Wisconsin. If you make it 320, I'll put on a sticker and a 14-day plate and off you go. 310. "Ah, don't make me squirm," Titus said, but he wasn't squirming. He was enjoying himself. "Add a fin onto that, and we'll call it a deal." I held out my hand. "315 works for me." "Yowza!" This time he shook with me, never minding the grease. Then he pointed to the sales booth. Today the ponytailed cutie was reading Confidential. "You'll want to pay the young lady, who happens to be my daughter. She'll write up the sale. When you're done, come around and I'll put on that sticker. Throw in a tank of gas, too." 40 minutes later, behind the wheel of a 1954 Ford Ragtop that now belonged to me, I was headed north toward Derry. I learned on a standard, so that was no problem, but this was the first car I'd ever driven with the gear shift on the column. It was weird at first, but once I got used to it, I would also have to get used to operating the headlight dimmer switch with my left foot. I liked it. And Bill Titus had been right about second gear. In second, the Sunliner went like a bastard. In Augusta, I stopped long enough to haul the top down. In Waterville, I grabbed a fine meatloaf dinner that cost 95 cents, apple pie a la mode included. It made the fat burger look overpriced. I hummed along with the Skyliners, the Coasters, the Dell Vikings, the Elegants. The sun was warm, the breeze ruffled my new short haircut, and the turnpike, nicknamed the Mile-a-Minute Highway, according to the billboards, was pretty much all mine. I seemed to have left my doubts of the night before sunk in the cow tank along with my cell phone and futuristic change. I felt good until I saw Derry. There was something wrong with that town, and I think I knew it from the first. I took Route 7 when the Mile-a-Minute Highway petered down to an asphalt-patched two-lane, and 20 miles or so north of Newport, I came over a rise and saw Derry hulking on the west bank of the Kenduskig under a cloud of pollution from God knew how many paper and textile mills, all operating full bore. There was an artery of green running through the center of town. From a distance, it looked like a scar. The town around that jagged green belt seemed to consist solely of sooty grays and blacks under a sky that had been stained urine yellow by the stuff billowing from all those smokestacks. I drove past several stands where the people minding the counters, or just standing side of the road and gaping as I drove past, looked more like inbred hillbillies from Deliverance than Maine farmers. As I passed the last of them, Bowers Roadside Produce, a large mongrel raced out from behind several heaped baskets of tomatoes and chased me, drooling and snapping at the Sunliner's rear tires. It looked like a misbegotten bulldog. Before I lost sight of it, I saw a scrawny woman in overalls approach it and begin beating it with a piece of board. This was the town where Harry Dunning had grown up, and I hated it from the first. No concrete reason, I just did. The downtown shopping area, situated at the bottom of three steep hills, felt pit-like and claustrophobic. My cherry red Ford seemed like the brightest thing on the street, a distracting and unwelcome, judging by most of the glances it was attracting, splash of color amid the black Plymouths, brown Chevrolets, and grimy delivery trucks. Running through the center of town was a canal filled almost to the top of its moss-splotched concrete retaining walls with black water. I found a parking space on Canal Street, A nickel in the meter bought me an hour's worth of shopping time. I'd forgotten to buy a hat in Lisbon Falls, and two or three storefronts up, I saw an outfit called Dairy Dress and Everyday, Central Maine's most debonair haberdashery. I doubted there was much competition in that regard. I'd parked in front of the drugstore and paused to examine the sign in the window. Somehow it sums up my feelings about Derry. The sour mistrust, the sense of barely withheld violence. Better than anything else, although I was there for almost 2 months and, with the possible exception of a few people I happened to meet, disliked everything about it. The sign read, "Shoplifting is not a kick or a groove or a gasser. Shoplifting is a crime, and we will prosecute. Nobbett Keene, owner and manager." And the thin, bespectacled man in the white smock who was looking at me just about had to be Mr. Keene. His expression did not say, "Come on in, stranger, poke around and buy something, maybe have an ice cream soda." Those hard eyes and that turned-down mouth said, "Go away. There's nothing here for the likes of you." Part of me thought I was making that up. Most of me knew I wasn't. As an experiment, I raised my hand in a hello gesture. The man in the white smock did not raise his in return. I realized that the canal I'd seen must run directly beneath this peculiar sunken downtown, and I was standing on top of it. I could feel hidden water in my feet thrumming the sidewalk. It was a vaguely unpleasant feeling, as if this little piece of the world had gone soft. A male mannequin wearing a tuxedo stood in the window of Dairy Dress and Everyday. There was a monocle in one eye and a school pennant in one plaster hand. The pennant read, "Dairy Tigers will slaughter Banger Rams." Even though I was a fan of school spirit, this struck me as a little over the top. Beat the Banger Rams, sure, but slaughter them? Just a figure of speech, I told myself and went in. A clerk with a tape measure around his neck approached me. His duds were much nicer than mine, but the dim overhead bulbs made his complexion look yellow. I felt an absurd urge to ask, "Can you sell me a nice summer straw hat, or should I just go fuck myself?" Then he smiled, asked how he could help me, and everything seemed almost normal. He had the required item, and I took possession of it for a mere $3.70. "A shame you'll have a short time to wear it before the weather turns cold," he said. I put the hat on and adjusted it in the mirror beside the counter. "Maybe we'll get a good stretch of Indian summer." Gently and rather apologetically, he tilted the hat the other way. It was a matter of 2 inches or less, but I stopped looking like a clodhopper on a visit to the big city and started to look like, well, Central Maine's most debonair time traveler. I thanked him. "Not at all, Mr. Amberson," I said and held out my hand. His grip was short, limp, and powdery with some sort of talcum. I restrained an urge to rub my hand on my sport coat after he released it. "In Derry on business?" "Yes. Are you from here yourself?" "Lifelong resident," he said, and sighed as if this were a burden. Based on my own first impressions, I guessed it might be. "What's your game, Mr. Amberson, if you don't mind me asking?" "Real estate. But while I'm here, I thought I'd look up an old army buddy. His name is Dunning. I don't recall his first name. We just used to call him Skip." The skip part was a fabrication, but it was true that I didn't know the first name of Harry Dunning's father. Harry had named his brothers and sister in his theme, but the man with the hammer had always been my father or my dad. "I'm afraid I couldn't help you there, sir." Now he sounded distant. Business was done, and although the store was empty of other customers, he wanted me gone. "Well, maybe you can with something else. What's the best hotel in town?" "That would be the Dairy Townhouse. Just turn back to Kandusky Avenue, take your right, and go up Mile Hill to Main Street. Look for the carriage lamps out front." "Up Mile Hill?" "That's what we call it, yes, sir. If there's nothing else, I have several alterations to make out back." When I left, the light had begun to drain from the sky. One thing I remember vividly about the time I spent in Derry during September and October of 1958 was how evening always seemed to come early. One storefront down from Derry Dress and Everyday was Macon's Sporting Goods, where the fall gun sale was underway. Inside, I saw two men sighting hunting rifles while an elderly clerk with a string tie and a stringy neck to go with it looked on approvingly. The other side of Canal appeared to be lined with working men's bars, the kind where you could get a beer and a shot for 50 cents, and all the music on the rockola would be C&W. There was the Happy Nook, the Wishing Well, which the habitués called the Bucket of Blood, I later learned, Two Brothers, the Golden Spoke, and the Sleepy Silver Dollar. Standing outside the latter, a quartet of blue-collar gents was taking the afternoon air and staring at my convertible. They were equipped with mugs of beer and cigarettes. Their faces were shaded beneath flat caps of tweed and cotton. Their feet were clad in the big no-color work boots my 2011 students called shit-kickers. Three of the four were wearing suspenders. They watched me with no expression on their faces. I thought for a moment of the mongrel that had chased my car, snapping and drooling. Then, crossed the street. "Gents," I said, "what's on tap in there?" For a moment, none of them answered. Just when I thought none of them would, the one sans suspenders said, "Bud and Mick, what else? You from away?" "Wisconsin," I said.
"Bully for you,"
one of them muttered.
"Late in the year for terrorists,"
another said. "I'm in town on business, but I thought I might look up an old service buddy while I'm here." No response to this, unless one of the men dropping his cigarette butt onto the sidewalk and then putting it out with a snot loogie the size of a small mussel could be termed an answer. Nevertheless, I pushed on. "Skip Dunning's his name. Do any of you fellows know a Dunning?" "Should hope to smile and kiss a pig," no suspenders said. "I beg pardon?" He rolled his eyes and turned down the corners of his mouth, the out-of-patience expression a man gives to a stupid person with no hope of ever being smart.
"Derry's full of Dunnings. Check the damn phone book."
He started inside. His posse followed. No suspenders opened the door for them, then turned back to me.
"What's that Ford gutting it?
V8?
Y-block."
Hoping I sounded as if I knew what it meant.
"Pretty good goa?"
"Not bad."
"Then maybe you should climb in and goa right on up the hill. They got some nice joints there. These bars are for millies."
No suspenders assessed me in a cold way I came to expect in Derry but never got used to.
"You'd get stared at, perhaps more, when the 11-7 lets out from Stryers and Boutilliers."
"Thanks. That's very kind of you." The cold assessment continued.
"You don't know much, do you?"
he remarked, then went inside. I walked back to my convertible. On that gray street with the smell of industrial smokes in the air and the afternoon bleeding away to evening, downtown Derry looked only marginally more charming than a dead hooker in a church pew. I got in, engaged the clutch, started the engine, and felt a strong urge to just drive away. Drive back to Lisbon Falls, climb up through the rabbit hole, and tell Al Templeton to find another boy. Only he couldn't, could he? He was out of strength and almost out of time. I was, as the New England saying goes, the trapper's last shot. I drove up to Main Street, saw the carriage lamps, they came on for the night just as I spotted them, and pulled into the turnaround in front of a Derry townhouse. 5 minutes later, I was checked in. My time in Derry had begun. By the time I got my new possessions unpacked, some of the remaining cash went into my wallet, the rest into the lining of my new valise. I was good and hungry, but before going down to dinner, I checked the telephone book. What I saw
caused my heart to sink. Mr. No Suspenders might not have been very welcoming, but he was right about Dunning selling cheap in Derry and the four or five surrounding hamlets that were also included in the directory. There was almost a full page of them. It wasn't that surprising, because in small towns certain names seemed to sprout like dandelions on a lawn in June. In my last 5 years teaching English at LHS, I must have had 24 Starbirds and Lemkes, some of them siblings, most of them first, second, or third cousins. They intermarried and made more. Before leaving for the past, I should have taken time to call Harry Dunning and ask him his father's first name. It would have been so simple. I surely would have if I hadn't been so utterly and completely gobsmacked by what Al had shown me and what he was asking me to do, but I thought, how hard can it be? It shouldn't take Sherlock Holmes to find a family with kids named Troy, Arthur, alias Tugga, Ellen, and Harry. With this thought to cheer me, I went down to the hotel restaurant and ordered a shore dinner, which came with clams and a lobster roughly the size of an outboard motor. I skipped dessert in favor of a beer in the bar. In the detective novels I read, bartenders were often excellent sources of information. Of course, if the one working the townhouse stick was like the other people I'd met so far in this grim little burg, I wouldn't get far. He wasn't. The man who left off his glass-polishing duties to serve me was young and stocky, with a cheery full moon of a face below his flat-top haircut.
"What can I get you, friend?"
The F-word sounded good to me, and I returned his smile with enthusiasm. "Miller Lite?" He looked puzzled.
"I never heard of that one, but I've got High Life."
Of course he hadn't heard of Miller Lite. It hadn't been invented yet. "That would be fine. Guess I forgot I was on the East Coast there for a second."
"Where are you from?"
He used a church key to whisk the top off a bottle and set a frosted glass in front of me. "Wisconsin, but I'll be here for a while." Although we were alone, I lowered my voice. It seemed to inspire confidence. "Real estate stuff. Gotta look around a little." He nodded respectfully and poured for me before I could.
"Good luck to you. God knows there's plenty for sale in these parts, and most of it going cheap."
"I'm getting out myself, end of the month.
Heading for a place with a little less edge to it."
"It doesn't seem all that welcoming," I said, "but I thought that was just a Yankee thing. We're friendlier in Wisconsin, and just to prove it, I'll buy you a beer."
"Never drink alcohol on the job, but I might have a Coke."
"Go for it."
"Thanks very much. It's nice to have a gent on a slow night."
I watched as he made the Coke by pumping syrup into a glass, adding soda water, and then stirring. He took a sip and smacked his lips.
"I like him sweet."
Judging by the belly he was getting, I wasn't surprised.
"That stuff about Yankees being standoffy is bullshit anyway," he said. "I grew up in Fort Kent, and it's the friendliest little town you'd ever want to visit. Why, when tourists get off the Boston and Maine up there, we just about kiss 'em hello. Went to bartending school there, then headed south to seek my fortune. This looked like a good place to start, and the pay's not bad, but—"
He looked around, saw no one, but still lowered his own voice.
"You want the truth, Jackson? This town stinks."
"I know what you mean. All those mills.
It's a lot more than that. Look around. What do you see?"
I did as he asked. There was a fellow who looked like a salesman in the corner, drinking a whiskey sour, but that was it. "Not much."
"That's the way it is all through the week. The pay's good, because there's no tips. The beer joints downtown do a booming business, and we got some folks in on Friday and Saturday nights, but otherwise, that's just about it. The carriage trade does its drinking at home, I guess."
He lowered his voice further. Soon he'd be whispering.
"We had a bad summer here, my friend. Local folks keep it as quiet as they can. Even the newspaper doesn't play it up. But there was some nasty work. Murders. Half a dozen at least. Kids. Found one down in the Barrens just recently. Patrick Hotstetter, his name was. All decayed.
The Barrens?
It's this swampy patch that runs right through the center of town. You probably saw it when you flew in.
I'd been in a car, but I still knew what he was talking about. The bartender's eyes widened.
That's not the real estate you're interested in, is it?
Can't say, I told him. If word got around, I'd be looking for a new job.
Understood, understood.
He drank half his Coke, then stifled a belch with the back of his hand.
But I hope it is. They ought to pave that goddamn thing over. It's nothing but stink water and mosquitoes. You'd be doing this town a favor. Sweeten it up a little bit.
Other kids found down there? I asked. A serial child murderer would explain a lot about the gloom I'd been feeling ever since I crossed the town line.
Not that I know of, but people say that's where some of the disappeared ones went because that's where all the big sewage pumping stations are. I've heard people say there's so many sewer pipes under Derry, most of them laid in the Great Depression, that nobody knows where all of them are. And you know how kids are.
Adventurous. He nodded emphatically.
Right with Eversharp. There's people who say it was some vag who's since moved on. Other folks says he was a local who dressed up like a clown to keep from being recognized. The first of the victims? This was last year, before I came. They found him at the intersection of Witcham and Jackson with his arm ripped clean off. Denborough was his name. George Denborough. Poor little tyke.
He gave me a meaningful look.
And he was found right next to one of those sewer drains. The ones that dump into the Barrens.
Christ.
Yeah.
I hear you using the past tense about all this stuff. I got ready to explain what I meant, but apparently this guy had been listening in English class as well as bartending school.
It seems to have stopped, knock on wood.
He rapped his knuckles on the bar.
Maybe whoever was doing it packed up and moved on, or maybe the son of a bitch killed himself. Sometimes they do that. That'd be good. That it wasn't any homicidal maniac in a clown suit who killed the little Corcoran boy. The clown who did that murder was the kid's own father, if you can believe it.
That was close enough to why I was here to feel like fate rather than coincidence. I took a careful sip of my beer.
Is that so? You bet it is. Dorsey Corcoran. That was the kid's name. Only 4 years old. And you know what his goddamn father did? Beat him to death with a recoilless hammer. A hammer. He did it with a hammer.
I maintained my look of polite interest. At least I hope I did. But I felt goose flesh go marching up my arms.
That's awful. Yeah, and not the worst.
He broke off and looked over my shoulder.
Get you another, sir?
It was the businessman.
Not me, he said, and handed over a dollar bill. I'm going to bed, and tomorrow I'm blowing this pop shop. I hope they remember how to order hardware in Waterville and Augusta, because they sure don't here. Keep the change, son. Buy yourself a DeSoto.
He plodded out with his head down.
See? That's a perfect example of what we get at this oasis.
The bartender looked sadly after his departing customer.
One drink, off to bed, and tomorrow? It's see you later, alligator. After a while, crocodile. If it keeps up, this burg's going to be a ghost town.
He stood up straight and tried to square his shoulders, an impossible task because they were as round as the rest of him.
But who gives a rip? Come October 1st, I'm gone. Down the road, happy trails to you until we meet again.
The father of this boy, Dorsey, he didn't kill any of the others?
Nah, he was alibied up. I guess he was the kid's stepfather, now that I think about it. Dickie Macklin. Johnny Keeson at the desk, he probably checked you in, told me he used to come in here and drink sometimes. Until he got banned for trying to pick up a stewardess and getting nasty when she told him to go peddle his papers. After that, I guess he did his drinking at the Spoke or the Bucket. They'll have anybody in those places.
He leaned over close enough for me to smell the aqua velva on his cheeks.
You want to know the worst?
I didn't, but thought I ought to, so I nodded.
There was also an older brother in that fucked-up family, Eddie. He disappeared last June. Just poof, gone, no forwarding, if you dig what I'm saying. Some people think he ran off to get away from Macklin, but anybody with any sense knows he would have turned up in Portland or Castle Rock or Portsmouth if that was the case. No way a 10-year-old can stay out of sight for long. Take it from me. Eddie Corcoran got the hammer, just like his little brother. Macklin just won't own up to it. He grinned, a sudden and sunny grin that made his moon face almost handsome. Have I talked you out of buying real estate and dairy yet, mister? That's not up to me, I said. I was flying on autopilot by then. Hadn't I heard or read about a series of child murders in this part of Maine? Or maybe watched it on TV, with only a quarter of my brain turned on while the rest of it was waiting for the sound of my problematic wife walking or staggering up to the house after another girl's night out. I thought so, but the only thing I remembered for sure about Derry was that there was going to be a flood in the mid-80s that would destroy half the town. It's not? No, I'm just the middleman. Well, good luck to you. This town isn't as bad as it was. Last July, folks were strung as tight as Doris Day's chastity belt. But it's still a long way from right. I'm a friendly guy, and I like friendly people. I'm splitting. Good luck to you, too, I said, and dropped $2 on the bar. Gee, sir, that's way too much. I always pay a surcharge for good conversation. Actually, the surcharge was for a friendly face. The conversation had been disquieting. Well, thanks, he beamed, then stuck out his hand. I never introduced myself. Fred Toomey. Nice to meet you, Fred. I'm George Amberson. He had a good grip. No talcum powder. Want a piece of advice? Sure. While you're in town, be careful about talking to kids. After last summer, a strange man talking to kids is apt to get a visit from the police if people see him doing it. Or he could take a beating. That sure wouldn't be out of the question. Even without the clown suit, huh? Well, that's the thing about dressing up in an outfit, isn't it? His smile was gone. Now he looked pale and grim, like everyone else in Derry, in other words. When you put on a clown suit and a rubber nose, nobody has any idea what you look like inside. I thought about that while the old-fashioned elevator creaked its way up to the third floor. It was true. And if the rest of what Fred Toomey had said was also true, would anybody be surprised if another father went to work on his family with a hammer? I thought not. I thought people would say it was just another case of Derry being Derry. And they might be right. As I let myself into my room, I had an authentically horrible idea. Suppose I changed things just enough in the next 7 weeks so that Harry's father killed Harry, too, instead of just leaving him with a limp and a partially fogged-over brain. That won't happen, I told myself. I won't let it happen. Like Hillary Clinton said in 2008, I'm in it to win it. Except, of course, she had lost. I ate breakfast the following morning in the hotel's Riverview restaurant, which was deserted except for me and the hardware salesman from last night. He was buried in the local newspaper. When he left it on the table, I snagged it. I wasn't interested in the front page, which was devoted to more saber-rattling in the Philippines, although I did wonder briefly if Lee Oswald was in the vicinity. What I wanted was the local section. In 2011, I'd been a reader of the Lewiston Sun Journal, and the last page of the B section was always headed School Doings. In it, proud parents could see their kids' names in print if they'd won an award, gone on a class trip, or been part of a community cleanup project. If the Derry Daily News had such a feature, it wasn't impossible that I'd find one of the Dunning kids listed. The last page of the news, however, contained only obituaries. I tried the sports pages and read about the weekend's big upcoming football game, Derry Tigers versus Bangor Rams.
Troy Dunning was 15, according to the janitor's essay. A 15-year-old could easily be a part of a team, although probably not a starter. I didn't find his name, and although I read every word of a smaller story about the town's peewee football team, the Tiger Cubs, I didn't find Arthur Tugga Dunning either. I paid for my breakfast and went back up to my room with the borrowed newspaper under my arm, thinking that I made a lousy detective. After counting the Dunnings in the phone book, 96, something else occurred to me. I had been hobbled, perhaps even crippled, by a pervasive internet society I had come to depend on and take for granted. How hard would it have been to locate the right Dunning family in 2011? Just plugging Tugga Dunning and Derry into my favorite search engine probably would have done the trick. Hit enter and let Google, that 21st century big brother, take care of the rest. In the Derry of 1958, the most up-to-date computers were the size of small housing developments, and the local paper was no help. What did that leave? I remembered a sociology prof I'd had in college, a sarcastic old bastard, who used to say, "When all else fails, give up and go to the library." I went there. Late that afternoon, hopes dashed, at least for the time being, I walked slowly up Mile Hill, pausing briefly at the intersection of Jackson and Wycham to look at the sewer drain, where a little boy named George Denbrough had lost his arm and his life, at least according to Fred Toomey. By the time I got to the top of the hill, my heart was pounding and I was puffing. It wasn't being out of shape. It was the stench of the mills. I was dispirited and a bit scared. It was true that I still had plenty of time to locate the right Dunning family, and I was confident I would. If calling all the Dunnings in the phone book was what it took, that was what I'd do, even at the risk of alerting Harry's time bomb of a father. But I was starting to sense what Al had sensed. Something working against me. I walked along Kansas Street so deep in thought that at first I didn't realize there were no more houses on my right. The ground now dropped away steeply into that tangled green riot of swampy ground that Toomey had called the Barrens. Only a rickety white fence separated the sidewalk from the drop. I planted my hands on it, staring into the undisciplined growth below. I could see gleams of murky standing water, patches of reeds so tall they looked prehistoric, and snarls of billowing brambles. The trees would be stunted down there, fighting for sunlight. There would be poison ivy, litters of garbage, and quite likely the occasional hobo camp. There would also be paths only some of the local kids would know, the adventurous ones. I stood and looked without seeing, aware but hardly registering the faint lilt of music, something with horns in it. I was thinking about how little I had accomplished this morning. "You can change the past," Al had told me, "but it's not as easy as you might think." What was that music? Something cheery with a little jump to it. It made me think of Christie back in the early days when I was besotted with her. When we were besotted with each other. Ba-da-da-ba-da-di-dee-da. Glenn Miller, maybe? I had gone to the library hoping to get a look at the census records. The last national one would have taken place 8 years ago in 1950 and would have shown three of the four Dunning kids, Troy, Arthur, and Harold. Only Ellen, who would be seven at the time of the murders, hadn't been around to be counted in 1950. There would be an address. It was true the family might have moved in the intervening 8 years, but if so, one of the neighbors would be able to tell me where they'd gone. It was a small city. Only the census records weren't there. The librarian, a pleasant woman named Mrs. Starrett, told me that in her opinion those records certainly belonged in the library, but the town council had for some reason decided they belonged in City Hall. They'd been moved there in 1954, she said.
That doesn't sound good, I told her, smiling. You know what they say, you can't fight City Hall. Mrs. Starrett didn't return the smile. She was helpful, even charming, but she had the same watchful reserve as everyone else I'd met in this queer place, Fred Toomey being the exception that proved the rule. Don't be silly, Mr. Amberson. There's nothing private about the United States Census. You march right over there and tell the city clerk that Regina Starrett sent you. Her name is Marcia Gay. She'll help you out, although they probably stored them in the basement, which is not where they ought to be. It's damp, and I shouldn't be surprised if there are mice. If you have any trouble at all, you come back and see me. So I went to City Hall, where a poster in the foyer said, "Parents, remind your children not to talk to strangers and to always play with friends." Several people were lined up at the various windows, most of them smoking, of course. Marcia Gay greeted me with an embarrassed smile. Mrs. Starrett had called ahead on my behalf and had been suitably horrified when Miss Gay told her what she now told me. The 1950 census records were gone, along with almost all of the other documents that had been stored in the City Hall basement. "We had terrible rains last year," she said. "They went on for a whole week. The canal overflowed, and everything down in the Low Town, that's what the old-timers called the city center, Mr. Amberson, everything in the Low Town flooded. Our basement looked like the Grand Canal in Venice for almost a month. Mrs. Starrett was right. Those records never should have been moved. And no one seems to know why they were, or who authorized it. I'm awfully sorry." It was impossible not to feel what Al had felt while trying to save Carolyn Poulin, that I was inside a kind of prison with flexible walls. Was I supposed to hang around the local schools, hoping to spot a boy who looked like the 60-years-plus janitor who had just retired, look for a 7-year-old girl who kept her classmates in stitches, wait to hear some kid yell, "Hey, Tugga, wait up!" Right. A newcomer hanging around the schools in a town where the first thing you saw at City Hall was a poster warning parents about stranger danger? If there was such a thing as flying directly into the radar, that would be it. One thing was for sure, I had to get out of the Derry townhouse. At 1958 prices, I could well afford to stay there for weeks, but that might cause talk. I decided to look through the classified ads and find myself a room I could rent by the month. I turned back toward the Low Town, then stopped. Ba-da-da, ba-da-dee-da-dum. That was Glenn Miller. It was In the Mood, a tune I had reason to know well. Curious, I walked toward the sound of the music. There was a little picnic area at the end of the rickety fence between the Kansas Street sidewalk and the drop into the barrens. It contained a stone barbecue and two picnic tables with a rusty trash barrel standing between them. A portable phonograph was parked on one of the picnic tables, a big black 78 RPM record spun on the turntable. On the grass, a gangly boy in tape-mended glasses and an absolutely gorgeous red-headed girl were dancing. At LHS, we called the incoming freshmen tweenagers, and that's what these kids were, if that. But they were dancing with grown-up grace. Not jitterbugging, either. They were swing dancing. I was charmed, but I was also, what, scared? A little bit. Maybe. I was scared for almost all the time I spent in Derry, but it was something else, too. Something bigger, a kind of awe, as if I had gripped the rim of some vast understanding, or peered through a glass darkly, you understand, into the actual clockwork of the universe. Because, you see, I'd met Christy at a swing dancing class in Lewiston, and this was one of the tunes we had learned to. Later, in our best year,
6 months before the marriage and 6 months after, we had danced in competitions, once taking fourth prize, also known as first also-ran, according to Christy, in the New England